change for Israel suspending plans to annex a large swath of the occupied West Bank. What's your reaction to that claim?
I think that's a joke. I think that's an absolute joke. It was because of the international reaction to Israel's annexation plans that they did not find it in their interest. We also saw a tremendous amount of opposition from U.S. Congress. And in fact, for Israel, it's more of the same because they already exercise de facto annexation over those lands. What it would have advanced and would have changed for Israelis is the fact that Netanyahu would have been playing to his right-wing base, that he was able to secure annexation during his tenure. But the reality on the ground doesn't change. This doesn't avert the takeover of those lands. If the UAE actually wanted to make a meaningful concession for Palestinians, it would have been withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Jordan Valley, at the very least, which is only 30% of the West Bank, let alone withdrawal from the entire occupied territories, and in fact, the right of return for Palestinian refugees. This leaves so much for want. And all of it is doublespeak and mirrors and shadows when they say that there are any meaningful concessions. We'll probably see Israel advance their interest and actually enact de jure annexation, notwithstanding this agreement.
Noor Erica, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian human rights attorney and legal scholar. We'll link to her piece, Trump Peace Deals for Israel, UAE, and Bahrain Are Shams. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area, and all over the world at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Northwest Cannabis Club in Portland. The CWC Walk-In Clinic provides assistance searching for jobs, expunging records, and connecting to community resources and volunteer opportunities. Again, that's the CWC Walk-In Expungement Clinic on Friday, September 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. at the Northwest Cannabis Club, 1195 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, open your web browser and type bit.ly/KBOO survey into the address line. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOO survey. And thanks.
We don't get fooled again.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, fire and smoke continue to overwhelm much of the state. More evidence emerges that ICE facilities are performing unwanted hysterectomies, and President Trump touts herd immunity while saying the pandemic is to, quote, go away. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 195 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the state's total case numbers up to 29,850. Oregon health officials also reported 2 new deaths, raising the total death toll in the state up to 521. The CDC director, Robert Redfield, said today that wearing a mask is, quote, more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine. Masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. Redfield's emphasis on mask wearing is in stark contrast to President Trump, who rarely wears a mask and holds massive maskless rallies. He stressed that if the country could commit to wearing the masks for 6 to 12 weeks, we'd, quote, bring this pandemic under control. At a news conference today, the head of the United Nations called the virus the world's, quote, number one global security threat. Nationally, as of Wednesday evening, more than 6.6 million people in the U.S. have been infected with COVID-19. At least 196,000 people have died. Over the past week, there have been an average of about 36,000 cases per day, a decrease of 12% from the average we were seeing 2 weeks earlier. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 29.6 million people in nearly every country. At least 930,000 people have died. Multiple wildfires continue to burn throughout the Portland metro and surrounding areas. Evacuations were issued on Tuesday for Lake County, where the Brattain Fire continues to burn. A red flag warning in the Brattain Fire area, Chiloquin, and elsewhere in that region is in effect for Wednesday, as dry and windy conditions may push fires to spread rapidly. Fire officials urge anyone who doesn't have to be in the area to leave. Paisley, a town with a population of 270, is among the areas under a mandatory evacuation order. Clackamas and Jackson counties, along with eastern Marion County, where the Beachy Fire continues to burn, remain under some level of evacuation order. As of this morning, the Beachy Fire has burned more than 191,000 acres and is 20% contained. The towns of Detroit, Edonha, and Gates remain evacuated. The Lion's Head Fire in Marion County has scorched over 183,000 acres and is 10% contained. The Riverside Fire in Clackamas County has covered 136,000 acres and is 3% contained. No measurable precipitation is expected in that area, and much of the county, including Estacada, remains under Level 3 Go Now evacuation orders. In Lane County, the Holiday Farm Fire has decimated Blue River and grown to 167,000 acres. It is 80% contained. The Archie Creek Fire in Douglas County covers 125,000 acres and is now 20% contained. The Thielson Fire near Diamond Lake covers nearly 8,000 acres and is 1% contained. No growth was reported for the 32,000-acre South Oban Chain Fire near Medford, which is 20% contained. The Slater Fire, which started in Northern California, now spans 137,000 acres. It's 10% contained. 2 new fires started in Klamath County on Tuesday near the area of the 14,000-acre 242 Fire, which is 21% contained. 2,500-acre Echo Mountain Complex Fire is now 40% contained. Level 3 evacuation orders remain in effect. A smoke advisory remains in effect for much of Oregon, though officials have lifted the advisory for the coastal region. Air quality in many areas ranges from unhealthy to hazardous, and residents are urged to stay in their homes as much as possible. FEMA is now on the ground in Oregon and will provide free hotel rooms or apartments for those displaced by the fires. Groups fighting climate change say that environmental policy should be part of a new stimulus bill that Congress will be working on in the coming weeks. KBOO's Samantha Law has more on the story.
Despite party line disagreements, Congress is expected to take up a new stimulus bill to rescue the COVID-battered economy, and groups fighting climate change say that environmental policy should be a part of it. They're urging lawmakers to support job creation by funding projects to cut pollution, protect the ocean, and move the nation away from fossil fuels. Jean Flemma with the Ocean Defense Initiative says the pandemic response can serve as an opening for progress.
This is an opportunity to begin the transition to a clean energy economy that will provide jobs, protect communities, and tackle the climate crisis while correcting inequities linked to environmental injustices and health disparities.
The goal is to get to net zero emissions by 2050 in order to keep global warming under 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. A recent U.S. Senate report suggests scaling up offshore wind, prohibiting new oil and gas development, working to decarbonize the shipping industry, and restoring coastal habitats like salt marshes that store carbon and protect towns from storm surge. The landmass in Oregon has been rising faster than the ocean for many years, but that trend is reversing. According to the online resource SeaLevelRise.org, sea levels are expected to increase by 6 inches in the next 16 years. Jennifer Savage with the Surfrider Foundation says the Oregon coast will have to adapt to a new normal.
In 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, extreme tides will become a normal tide, and at some point, the low tide won't be low enough for the sand to be uncovered.
Higher tides and warmer waters threaten estuaries that support local fisheries and serve as buffers to prevent flooding. For the KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Samantha Law.
On Monday, a whistleblower came forward with a complaint alleging that multiple non-consensual hysterectomies were performed at an ICE facility in Georgia. Now, many others have come forward with similar stories. KBOO's Nat Moon reports.
Earlier this week, a whistleblower filed a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General, alleging that high rates of hysterectomies had been performed on women detained at a privately owned immigration jail in Georgia. The complaint was filed by the human rights group Project South and included accounts by the whistleblower Dawn Wooten, a licensed nurse at the facility, as well as five women who had the procedure done between October and December of last year. The facility at the center of the complaint is an ICE facility called Irwin County Detention Center. The accounts were consistent with other accounts given in separate interviews to The Intercept. All those interviewed requested anonymity for fear of reprisal. One detainee compared the center to an experimental concentration camp, saying it was, quote, like they're experimenting with our bodies. Though the whistleblower did not identify the doctor, according to other interviews, the doctor is Mahendra Amin, an OBGYN specialist based in Douglas, Georgia. The current detainees at the facility said they were pressured by the doctor to undergo partial or full hysterectomies. One of the women estimated that as many as 20 others were recommended for surgery. All of the women said no interpreter was provided. Today, Representative Pramila Jayapal on Twitter wrote that there may be at least 17 women subjected to these unnecessary procedures, all of which contain many consistencies and raise serious questions about the entire for-profit detention system that is, quote, complicit in the abuses and has long neglected the health, well-being, and human rights of immigrants. The United States has a largely unacknowledged and devastating history of forced sterilization. The state of Indiana passed the world's first eugenic sterilization law in 1907, after which many other states followed suit. Under the laws, nearly 60,000 people were sterilized in procedures that were, quote, compulsory, forced, involuntary, and under the justifications that the people who were being sterilized were unfit to reproduce. So says Alexandra Minnesota Stern, an associate dean at University of Michigan and director of the Sterilization and Social Justice Lab. Women and people of color were largely targeted in these procedures as eugenics, quote, amplified sexism and racism. In California, people of Mexican descent were disproportionately sterilized, while in North Carolina, black women received the bulk of the violence. Those laws later became models for Nazi Germany. Sterilizations also occurred in Los Angeles County Hospital in the 1970s, spurring protests and a lawsuit. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Hurricane Sally made landfall on the Alabama coast this morning with winds over 100 miles per hour and torrential rain, with its 2 mile per hour pace intensifying the flooding. Last night, before landfall, Sally dropped almost 2 feet of rain, spun off multiple tornadoes, and knocked out power for hundreds of thousands of people. David Eversole, a National Weather Service forecaster in Mobile, Alabama, said, quote, "It's not common that you start measuring rainfall in feet." As the hurricane moves inland, more than 26 million people in parts of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas are under flash flood warnings or watches. At the start of the week, Sally was one of the record-tying string of five storms rolling in simultaneously in the Atlantic. While the U.S. had its most COVID-19 deaths in a day, President Trump insisted the disease would be stopped through herd immunity with or without a vaccine. In a town hall meeting moderated by George Stephanopoulos of ABC, he said, quote, "We're going to be okay, and it's going away." He added, quote, "You'll develop like a herd immunity." Experts say to reach herd immunity to the virus, about 65% of the U.S. population, which would be over 200 million people, would have to be infected with coronavirus, which, given the current U.S. death rate from COVID-19, would mean millions of deaths. Epidemiologist Eric Feigl-Ding tweeted last night, quote, "Herd immunity without a vaccine is deadly. Trump's idiocy on science is killing us." You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We would like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stick around at 5:30 for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be hearing an interview with DJ Lee on her new book, Remote, Finding Home in the Bitterroots. At 5:45, we'll hear news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising, then at 6:30, Free Culture Radio, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 62, and tomorrow expect cloudy skies with a high of 75. Today in history, in 1993, Aboriginal Australian activist, artist, and educator Ujuru Nunukul died. She is remembered as a strong, charismatic leader whose beautiful poetry captured the strength of Aboriginal culture. The quote of the day is from Nunukul, who said, quote, "Let no one say the past is dead. The past is all about us and within." Navajo President Jonathan Nez spoke with the nation about staying open to COVID-19 vaccine trials. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez addressed concerns about the tribe taking part in COVID-19 vaccine trials. In a virtual town hall Tuesday, Nez urged Navajo citizens to look at the bigger picture, saying it's for the betterment of the future and the Navajo Nation.
I know there's a lot of comments about guinea pigs, using us as guinea pigs, and people saying that, why are you allowing this to happen? You know, throughout this country, there have been many viruses that have plagued us as human beings. And there have been people who have utilized their own bodies to find cures for these types of viruses.
He says no one's being forced to participate. The trials are being offered on a voluntary basis.
And so if people, Navajo people, want to volunteer to try these vaccination clinical trials for COVID-19, then I don't think we should stand in the way. There are thousands of people that are signing up for clinical trials so that people don't have to go through this virus. And those that have gone through this virus know it's not a fun experience.
Nez says he'll host a town hall Monday with Dr. Anthony Fauci, a top U.S. health official, to discuss COVID-19 and trial vaccines. The Navajo Nation is taking part in a Pfizer vaccine trial led by Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health. Enrollment will begin in mid-September for people between ages 18 to 85 who have not had a prior COVID-19 infection. They'll receive two doses of the vaccine and be monitored for 2 years. As of Tuesday, the Navajo Nation reported 5 new cases of COVID-19, bringing the total number of positive cases to 9,982. Some members of the Crow tribe, including Chairman A.J. Not Afraid, presented Vice President Mike Pence with a buffalo hide during a rally this week in Montana. Not Afraid, in comments to the crowd streamed by KULR, backed the re-election campaign of President Trump and touted the Crow tribe's coal industry, which he says is supported by the administration.
President Trump had endorsed and amended, executed the Terror Act, which enabled the Crow tribe into permitting its own mineral resources.
Not Afraid also threw in his support for Montana Republican state and congressional candidates. The National Congress of American Indians Tribal Unity Impact Days kicked off Wednesday in Washington, D.C. to provide tribal leaders with the opportunity to engage with members of Congress in a virtual setting. The census, COVID-19, public safety, and other topics will be addressed during 2 days of roundtables. Key Indian country allies are expected to participate, and 2 of the 4 Native American members of Congress, Representatives Tom Cole and Deb Haaland. And on Thursday, a virtual seminar will provide information about COVID-19 relief aid for tribal governments. Senator Steve Daines and Congresswoman Charisse Davids will join some tribal leaders to talk about the CARES Act, which includes relief dollars for tribes. Since March, tribal leaders have voiced concerns about federal red tape and the slow pace of COVID-19 resources reaching Indian country. The panel will look at how Congress can enhance support to Indian country as members return from summer recess to debate additional relief packages. The event is being hosted by the Harvard Project on American Indian Economic Development. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Des Moines, Iowa is among the many cities that have experienced increased protesting and increased police brutality. A recent police letter sent to a city council member continues to fuel the tensions. Mike Moen has more on the story.
In many U.S. cities, relationships have soured between police and protesters, who say officers use strong-arm tactics during demonstrations against racial injustice. In Iowa, those tensions are on the rise again. A Des Moines community group is calling attention to a letter sent to a city council member who tweeted concerns about the August arrest of 2 Black Liberation Movement activists. The charges came after a nonviolent protest. Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement claims the letter, which criticized the council member's concerns, was sent by a police union in secret. Group member Sharon Zanderzakis says it speaks volumes about leadership.
We're looking at who's policing who. Is it the police policing our city elected officials, or is our elected officials able to police the police?
She says this could be viewed as another way to suppress voices. The group says the Des Moines Gold Braid organization sent the letter to avoid a public records request. The Des Moines Register received a copy and confirms the group's claims about the content. The union called the council member's statements unprofessional and said the department's actions were a de-escalation tactic. City officials, including the council member who received the letter, say they have empathy for protesters, but also acknowledge the union's right to free speech. Zanderzakis says it's disheartening that after some of the summer tension had eased, the union sought intimidation through a backdoor form of communication.
If there is going to be a bridge of repair between community and police, it has to start with transparency.
At various points this summer, police officials and protesters did show signs of unity, but during some of the demonstrations, they clashed with those marching by using tear gas and pepper spray. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The last of the year's primaries took place in Delaware yesterday. With more on the story, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
In Delaware, the big question would be, is there any Republican who can mount like a serious challenge at the statewide level? Because the Republican Party in Delaware has had a pretty tough go of it over the past 10 years in terms of trying to win statewide offices.
University of Delaware Professor Paul Brewer says his state's so blue, the surprise would be if yesterday's Republican primary winners had a chance in November against the Democratic incumbents, Governor John Carney and Senator Chris Coons. Coons is an established moderate who beat his more progressive opponent. With 50 days to go, Republicans face an uphill battle.
It doesn't give challengers much time to start putting together a general election campaign.
Presidential campaigning is in full throttle now. In Pennsylvania, Trump attended an ABC News town hall. In Florida, former Vice President Joe Biden met with veterans and unveiled a proposal aimed at supporting Puerto Rico, not only regarding statehood, but providing emergency aid, debt relief, and investment in infrastructure. Jose Parra, with consulting firm Prospero Latino, has worked on Latino outreach for prominent Democrats, hoping Biden's plan will galvanize the 1.2 million Puerto Ricans living in Florida. He also wants Democrats to do more to dispel false messaging painting Biden as a, quote, socialist.
Basically, the way Republicans and Trump are trying to win the Hispanic vote is through a lying campaign, because obviously the socialism message is malarkey, as Biden would say, but the fact is that it has stuck.
Biden is 25 points ahead among Florida Latinos, but that lead narrows in the state overall and among Latinos in Miami-Dade County. The socialist mislabel is especially effective there, Parra thinks, because Miami's home to many folks who dealt with dictatorships in Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela.
That's a raw nerve that really makes people perk up whenever they hear that word socialism, whereas you don't have that initial trauma from having lived through a dictatorship in other parts of the country.
If Biden wins, he will be the nation's second Catholic president. The Biden campaign has recruited a new team of 36 prominent Catholics as national co-chairs of their Catholics for Biden outreach. After that announcement, the conservative group Catholic Vote launched an ad campaign worth almost $10 million against Biden in swing states. Trump has attacked Biden's faith, saying his challenger would, quote, hurt God, unquote, if elected. At an Evangelicals for Trump rally in Georgia, Eric Trump stumped for his father. Just before that, Democrats held an online panel with faith leaders across Georgia who support Biden. Here's the Reverend Dr. Charles Goodman.
One thing that we believe as faith leaders is that you can live in tension. We can support law enforcement, but also denounce police brutality. We can support the sanity of life, but also believe that people should have the choice of their bodies. This is a critical election.
And breaking with a 175-year tradition, Scientific American issued its first presidential endorsement, backing Biden for his, quote, fact-based plans to protect our health, our economy, and the environment. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
In many areas of the world, growing a classic crop like apples is becoming more and more difficult. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Crunchy, ripe apples are a fall treat, but in many areas, growing apples is becoming more difficult as the climate changes. In the Midwest, for example, orchards are experiencing increasingly hot and wet weather.
What it's done is made fungal diseases more and more of a problem later and later in the season.
Rami Abaromia owns Adams to Apples, an organic orchard in Wisconsin. To improve his yields, he grows disease-resistant strains like Honeycrisp. And he has planted his trees closer together so that they can grow on trellises, almost like grapevines.
So there's a lot more light and air that's going into the tree, so that means less disease.
Abaromia also prunes his trees to promote good air circulation. And when needed, he applies an organic fungicide. But even if the fruit looks great, rain can cause other problems for apple growers. For example, wet weather can deter customers from visiting U-Pick orchards that also offer hayrides and other fall fun. So Abaromia says if the trend towards wetter weather continues, the industry will need to adapt.
I think there's going to need to be a lot of sharing between growers to say, okay, this is what works, so you got to do this to be able to succeed.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is counting down to November.
Feels like a countdown to chaos, various warning lights flashing red. Portland's air will clear soon as fires surge in southern Oregon. Hurricane Sally lands strong in Alabama while a new storm builds in the Atlantic. We might have the first hurricane to start with a Z. As COVID waits to return to center stage, with the virus unabated in most of the world, Trump is counting on herd stupidity, not science. As science tries to figure out why tens of thousands of migratory birds have died in New Mexico, why whales are holding meetings at sea and attacking small boats, DeJoy paid $500,000 to be Postmaster General, and he expects a good return on his investment. Caputo and Stone are calling for armed rebellion, and several of my friends are considering buying their first guns. 49 days and counting, not to lift off but break down. As the media keeps feeding us the crazy threats from Washington and the right, does it matter how clean the air or our minds are? Yes, it does. Every forest fire leaves many trees standing. Some fine mushrooms flourish where fire has been. As a lot of trash gets cleared away, we will see again how beautiful this land and its creatures are. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Nat Moon, and Samantha Lau. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our fall membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be hearing from author DJ Lee about her new book, Remote: Finding Home in the Bitterroots. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is DJ Lee, author of the new book, Remote: Finding Home in the Bitterroots, from Oregon State University Press. DJ is a Regents Professor of Literature and Creative Writing at Washington State University, the director of the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness History Project, and a scholar fellow at the Black Earth Institute. She's published 8 books on literature, history, and ecology. Remote is her first memoir. The book won first place for memoir in the Idaho Writers Guild 2020 competition, and it was featured as one of the most anticipated books of 2020 by the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association. In the words of writer and Idaho native Kim Barnes, Remote is part adventure story, part cautionary tale. DJ Lee's quest weaves through memory and meaning like a broken trail. The ghost she is searching for, her grandmother, her grandfather, her friend lost in the wilderness and never found, appear and disappear in moments of mystery. Always, what she offers is a map that we might follow. More than blood, it's story that binds us, all that we have to make sense of our lives. DJ, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ken.
Before we started, I usually start off with a little intro here on how you're doing during the pandemic, but the book is fascinating. There's so much to talk about, so let's get right to it. It starts out in the first few pages as a mystery. A friend of yours goes missing in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, and you join the search to find her. Can you tell us a little bit about your missing friend, Connie Sailor Johnson, who was 76 when she was last seen, and I think you had met her about 13 years earlier?
Yeah, so Connie was a legend back in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, which is a 1.3 million acres, and then it's also attached to the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness to make over 5,000 acres of roadless land, so it's a huge place. Connie was a legend before she went missing. She loved hiking alone. She was also just extremely people-oriented. She was originally a teacher, and teaching was what she did constantly. She just was oriented that way. So she was cooking for a hunting camp up at a place called Big Rock in early October 2018. They went on a little side trip for a few days, and they think that she went for a hike up to the rock, and at that point nobody knows what happened to her. I still don't. It's was just so shocking because she was so beloved by people far and wide across the U.S. People came out of the woodwork to try to search for her, that she, of all people who knew so much about the place, would disappear is still mind-boggling.
Now, the mystery aspect is a big part of the book, of course, but it evolves into much more. A history not just of the Selway Bitterroot area and the Namipu people, also known as the Nez Perce, who are its native inhabitants, and I didn't know this, but going back over 11,000 years. But it's also a family history as well, the book, a meditation on women and wilderness, even a ghost story. And you've said you started out thinking you were just writing a history book because that's your background as a scholar and an academic. And you started writing the book before Connie's disappearance. How did remote change in about the 15 years you worked on it?
Yeah, well, I had originally started it as a research project when when my grandmother died. She and my grandfather had lived back there for 12 years in the 20s, 30s, and early 40s. And I didn't know anything about the place because my grandfather had died when I was an infant, so I never knew about it. My grandmother never talked about it, even though I was very close with her. When she died, that she left a box full of all of this information about the wilderness, and that to me was her way of saying, you need to go find out about this place. So along with friends and family and people like Connie, who worked for the Forest Service, archaeologists, artists, I went in many, many times thinking that I actually did do a research project. I started an archive and did 50 oral histories of people who'd lived and worked back there over the years. But at some point, I realized I had done all of this personal writing about it too, and that to tell this story apart from my own personal story and the mystery of my family, which there's still things that I don't know and will never know about my grandfather especially, but also my grandmother, I actually had to learn a different way of writing, which was a surprise to me, because at that point I'd written like 6 academic and scholarly books, and I just thought, oh yes, I can just do this, but I couldn't. So I actually had to go back and get my MFA to learn how to weave narrative and history and meaning together.
I was going to, in the next question, mention your grandparents, so George and Esther Case. And as you said, Esther, your grandmother left you all these incredible documents. And yet you call her in the book the Queen of Concealment. There's a little bit of a paradox there.
Yeah, well, because she had this habit when you asked her things that she didn't want to talk about, like my grandfather, like certain parts of her past, she'd just say, oh, there's nothing to say. Or let's go out to the garden. She had her way of pivoting and diverting. But she did keep a lot of things that then surfaced after she was gone. A lot of relics, some old movies that my grandfather had shot in the 20s and 30s. He had one of the first moving cameras, personal moving cameras, and he shot so much footage back there in the wilderness, mainly of animals. He was obsessed with animals. So she kept all this stuff. It must have had meaning for her, even though during her lifetime she denied that it did.
Now, the book is very much, all these mysteries, these ghosts, and of course the wilderness itself, but it's also has a central theme of mother and daughter relationships. And that's between your mother, Shirley, who accompanies you on several of your backpacking trips into the wilderness, and the one between Shirley and her mother, Esther, who we've talked a little bit about. And that was somewhat of a dysfunctional relationship between Shirley and Esther. And you said growing up you had a similar relationship, somewhat similar, between your mother and you. How did these relationships change over the course of researching and writing the book?
Well, I think that was my main motivation, without really realizing it, for choosing this topic as my next kind of research topic. I mean, ostensibly, I needed to find out the history of this place because that was what I did as training. But when I look back, I think it was about trying to heal those relationships. And in the book, I do talk somewhat in a few chapters about the rising field of epigenetics, which scientists have now proven that that certain traumatic events that happen to us or our ancestors are actually passed down through our DNA. And the country most responsible for doing the kind of healing work of epigenetics is Germany, post-war Germany, and not the Jewish people, but the Germans. So it's, you know, dealing with guilt that may not be yours, but it may be your ancestors.
So the guilt in some respects can be inherited.
Yes.
Genetically.
Yeah, guilt and trauma and fear and a lot of things. So I began to see that kind of healing taking place through these different trips into the wilderness, and especially with my mom. She and my father volunteered at one of the remote outposts called Shearer Airstrip for 5 years, and I went back there every year with them. And I feel like those weeks that I spent with them were really healing weeks. And I started, at first I didn't care for the wilderness because I felt like maybe the trauma that caused the kind of difficulties in the mother-daughter relationships had stemmed from this land, and maybe it did. But I started to realize the land also had this healing effect. So the very thing that caused us to feel shattered was the thing that brought us intimacy. And that happened over many years, and I didn't realize the kind of reversal of that until quite late in the process.
Yeah, the book does get into the spiritual and what some people might call the mystical aspects of the wilderness. In a previous interview, you called the Selway Bitterroots a mythological place, and traditionally, in religious literature, spiritual literature, the wilderness is where people go to have dreams and visions. Did you experience that here? Did that healing take place, in other words?
Yeah, and I have to say that because I'm a scholar, by training, I resisted the mythological and the mystical aspects of the wilderness for quite a while, and I was very hard-nosed about it, and I did not want to romanticize it or read into it. And I know that the Nimiipuu and the Salish used the land for not only for homes, but also for their own spiritual ritual. So I didn't want to like appropriate or tag on to that. But honestly, wilderness has been a spiritual place for Celtic people, for many early peoples, you know. And so eventually the wilderness broke me and was like, damn it, I'm mystical and you have to accept it. So I do feel something nostalgic and I do feel when I'm not there, and then when I'm there, I definitely get this sense of awe and something larger than myself at work that I will never understand and probably not meant to understand.
I love in the book and in some of your past interviews, you make the connection between going into the wilderness as you did and writing a memoir, which you did. So you had that kind of double whammy experience. You said that writing this book has been like going into the wilderness itself. It forces you to face things you'd rather not. You have to open yourself to it and let it do its work. And you used an epigraph, a quote from the writer W.G. Sebald, a German, since we're talking about Germans.
Yeah.
Ghosts and writers meet in their concern for the past. Was that just something you picked up on as you were writing, as you were backpacking into the wilderness on your quest here? and also learning this different way to write, which you talked about, rather than straight academic, personal memoir, kind of braided together.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you noticed that epigraph, because W.G. Sebald was probably my biggest influence. I don't know if you've read his books, but he's so, you know, he's amazingly intelligent and gifted, but he does weave large historical events and quirky, you know, he kind of goes for the quirky and the odd moments within these larger historical movements with the personal. Although he doesn't strictly write memoir, but he, in this very personal voice, but also traveling through. And so I feel like his sensibility matched up most closely with the journey that I was on. I did get a lot more personal because I was going, you know, because I explored relationships.
And
more.
Your family relationship, yeah. your mother yeah. and grandmother too.
Yeah, right. But he remains my absolute favorite writer still.
We've been talking with DJ Lee, author of the new book, Remote, Finding Home in the Bitterroots, from Oregon State University Press. DJ will be reading, along with Tina Ontiveros, at a special live stream event organized by Portland's Two Rivers Bookstore tomorrow, Thursday, September 17th at 6:30 p.m. You could find out more on DJ's website, debbiejlee.com, and you can register for the event at tworiversbooks.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
Yeah!